Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Alan Pike, filling in for Tracy Ross.
So, Alan, what do we have on today's episode?
We're going to be talking about the water crisis in Flint at some length with one of the journalists who helped expose that whole story. We're going to be talking about Walmart and the havoc they've managed to wreak here in D.C. But before we get into that, I think we've got a little bit of other news to sort of halfway's break here on the show, right?
I'm so excited to be congratulating our colleagues here at the Center for American Progress on voting to unionize. Woo! Woo! With the IFPTE, Local 70 is the chapter, joining the Economic Policy Institute and the Center for Economic Policy Research and several of the other key partner organizations and think tanks here in D.C. who work on progressive issues and policies like we do.
And I know that I can speak for my Think Progress colleagues in saying that we're extremely proud of our CAP colleagues' achievement here, and we look forward to being both union shops, although we're with WGAE, which I think may mean that we have to do like a Jets and Sharks like dance fight at some point. We're still looking into that with the lawyers, but we're going to figure that out and settle it once and for all.
Only if I get to hold the hose.
Sure. Why not?
Awesome. All right. Well, congrats to our brothers and sisters. And now the Flint water crisis. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. You've probably read a lot about the Flint water crisis and how it came about, but a lot of the story still remains untold, and new details are coming to light every day. With us to discuss the untold story of the Flint water crisis is Kurt Guyette, an investigative reporter with the ACLU of Michigan, who was not only instrumental in bringing the crisis to light, but who participated in doing what the government had failed to do. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for existing, period.
Well, to help get us started, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been following the Flint water crisis, but take us back to the beginning. How did this all start?
It started in April of 2014 when the city of Flint was under the control of an emergency manager appointed by Governor Rick Snyder. And in Michigan has a very extreme receivership law, which allows the state to take over complete control of cities, school districts, counties that are in financial distress. And Flint was one of those cities. And like the other cities and school districts, it is a majority African-American city, and it has a high poverty rate. It has about 40% of the people of Flint live below the poverty line. And so with this emergency manager under control and the power of elected officials eliminated, that's one of the extreme functions of this emergency manager law. It takes away the authority of duly elected local officials. They only have whatever power the emergency manager chooses to give them. They only get paid if the emergency manager chooses to pay them. So essentially, they're employees of the emergency manager. In order to save money while a new pipeline was being built, this, and we don't know for sure if it's the emergency manager or it's the governor's office, but in any event, the state essentially decides, in order to save a projected $5 million to switch from the clean, safe Detroit water that Flint had been getting for 50 years to begin using the polluted Flint River. You know, Flint is the home of General Motors. It's just an old industrial town, and like old industrial towns, just about everywhere, the river was the dumping ground for the waste. And so just on a purely financially driven decision, began using the Flint River. And as soon as they switched over, people knew immediately that the water was not good. It didn't smell good. It didn't taste good. It didn't look good. You know, they described sometimes it would smell like feces with chlorine overtones to it, you know, and it was just horrible. And but all along, the city and state officials kept assuring them that the water was safe. Then it started to have problems with E. coli contamination. To treat the E. coli, they increased the amount of chlorine being used to kill the bacteria. Increasing the chlorine led to elevated levels of a carcinogenic byproduct of chlorine called total trihalomethanes. That went on for months and months and months before they notified residents that they were being exposed to that. And that was in January when that finally got, the public was allowed to know that they were drinking unsafe levels of a carcinogen.
Well, I want to interrupt you quickly there and just ask you, you just said something, you used a very interesting phrase there. You said the public was allowed to know at that point. There were early warnings about this. You were instrumental in actually raising some of these early warnings about the water and its contamination. Why were they ignored? And what do you mean when you say the public hadn't previously been allowed to know?
Well, for specifically for the TTHM problem, the law is that it is not until there are three consecutive quarters that they are out of compliance that their officials are required to notify people of the problem. Nothing saying they can't notify them, but they don't have to be notified. And the state, in the form of an emergency manager, chose not to tell the people what they were being exposed to until the law said they absolutely had to. But people were outraged when that came out. But that's part of the problem with the whole emergency manager law. These emergency managers are like hired guns that come in from someplace else. They don't have any connection to the community. They don't have any responsibility to the community. Their only responsibility is to the governor that appoints them. So there's a complete disconnect going on between the people running a community and the community itself. It's not like they have local elected officials that have any power that they can vote off out of office if they're doing a bad job. It's really the starkest example imaginable of what happens when you take democracy away from people.
Yeah, I was going to say, because anybody who's employed as a public health official of any kind is going to see test results like that and think, oh God, we have to tell people to stop drinking this water. Not, well, how long do I have to try to cover
to
up,
cover
to,
it
to,
up.
To fix this so that we don't have to tell people? It's such a, it speaks to the way that the law in Michigan for financially dire situations at the municipal level has flipped around the responsibility to the public that's supposed to be imbued into public service.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, what they do is they take a democracy and replace it with an austerity-driven autocracy. And we see what happens. In the case of Flint, tragically, it meant that a town's water supply was contaminated and people, especially children, were subjected to lead poisoning. You know, it's the most egregious, which is why I started covering it, because I was hired here at the ACLU of Michigan to investigate issues around this emergency manager law. And when I saw, I was at a meeting up in Flint almost a year ago, and that's when the TTH problem was being exposed, and people were saying at this meeting, why didn't you tell us? And the emergency manager said, well, as soon as we found out about it, we started working on it. And they go, but yeah, that's not telling us.
Right.
And he goes, as soon as we found out about it, we began working on it. Yeah, but that's not telling us. And he looks at him and he says, well, I'm telling you now. And it was just so callous and showed such disregard for these people that were being exposed to a carcinogen. You know, it was not like it was some piddly thing that they were upset about. You know, it's like, man, this is a story that got to be told. And so myself and this really wonderful young filmmaker, Kate Levy, went up to Flint, and we started making a short documentary about what was going on. And this was before the lead issue really became known. Although it started right around the time that we started going up there, the EPA started sending emails to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality which oversees the water testing in Flint, look at, we just saw these lead results from this one family. They're really high. What's going on? What kind of corrosion control are you using? And the DEQ writes back, oh, don't worry, it's under control. We have a corrosion control program in place. But the truth is that they weren't applying corrosion control, which is another sort of crazy thing about all this and really inexplicable, because the Flint River is about five times more corrosive than the Detroit water, which comes from Lake Huron. And so at the, and Detroit puts in phosphates as a corrosion control. So Flint, with the MDEQ making the decisions, at the time when the corrosion control is more needed than ever because the water is so much more corrosive, stops using corrosion control. And so as soon as they start using the river water, which has a very high salt content, it starts tearing up the pipes because it's more corrosive and there's no corrosion control. And so that's really when the lead contamination started. But it didn't really start to show itself for a little while, because the film, that the protective coating, lasted for a little bit before it started getting chewed up.
And you mentioned that there was one particular household that had been tested, and that was part of what led this one individual at the at Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality, Miguel Toral, to realize that there was a problem. And he was sort of the Cassandra, right, who said, wait, you know, guys, there's something here, and nobody listened to him. But then you worked with him to show that it wasn't just that one household. Tell us a little bit about your role in that.
Yeah, so there's the Leanne Walters is a mom, and she demanded in February that the city test her water for lead. And it came back at 107 parts per billion. The federal action level is 15 parts per billion, and you know, there's no safe level of lead whatsoever. But the 107 parts per billion is really high.
That's seven times what you're saying is what's supposed to be the trigger point.
Right. Then she had tested a second time and it came back at like 397. And that's, and she sent those results to the EPA, and it got into the hands, luckily, of Miguel Del Toro, who was a water expert at Region 5 of the EPA in Chicago. And he took a personal interest. He went to Flint because Flint city officials were saying, oh, you know, the problem is lead plumbing inside the Walters home. Well, like, they bought a vacant house, the Walters family, and like a lot of vacant houses in Flint and Detroit, what happens is the scrappers come in and they steal every thing that's of value, including the plumbing, if it's metal. And so all the plumbing had been stripped out, and it was replaced with PVC. So there was no lead inside the house. It was all coming from outside the house. Del Toro hooked the Walters family up with Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech, and you guys in D.C. know Mark Edwards well. He's the guy who heroically exposed the lead in Washington, D.C.'s water in the early 2000s. And so he conducted, he worked with Walters. He sent her 30 sample bottles and walked her through conducting a very thorough, extensive test of basically the system going from the, as it comes out the tap, what it's like in the internal plumbing, what it's like in the service line, which is the line that goes from the water main to the house, and then the water main itself. And out of those 30 samples, one of them came back with lead levels of 13,200 parts per billion, which is 2.5 times what it takes to be classified as hazardous waste. So this is happening in, you know, April, May. In June, Del Toro writes this internal memo for the EPA, but he's a longtime EPA employee. He knows how the bureaucracy works. And he's afraid that this memo is going to get buried. And the memo says essentially, okay, we got hazardous waste levels of water going into this one house. That you know, we don't know if that's an anomaly or not, but the science behind all this says you're using corrosive water, you're not using corrosion control. There's a lot of lead service lines throughout Flint. This is not an isolated problem. This got to be a real issue throughout the city. And so, and he saw this as a public health emergency. And really, Mr. Del Toro is the unsung hero in all of this. He gives that memo to Leanne. And because Kate and I had been up there taking seriously the concerns being expressed by residents, and our video, Hard to Swallow, had just been released, and Leanne believed that we really cared about what was going on there, and that beyond that, that we would be unafraid to tell the truth about what was going on there, she gave us the memo. We published it, and that was really the spark that ignited the whole chain reaction of events that brought us to where we are now. But the next thing that happened was that we published the memo. I write a story about it. I interview Mr. Del Toro. I interview Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality completely blew me off, wouldn't answer my questions. But fortunately, Michigan Radio, which is the public radio here, one of the public radio outlets here in Michigan, recognized the potential importance of this memo, picked it up, and ran with it. They did get the MDEQ to respond. The response from this guy, Brad Werfel, who has since rightfully resigned in disgrace because of his handling of all this, says, goes on the radio and says, look, it, when it comes to lead in the water, people of Flint can just relax. There's no problem whatsoever. You know, nothing to see here, folks. Keep moving, right? And so then at that point is, man, how do we get to the truth? And the solution was that a group, a very varied group of really, really great people in Flint called the Coalition for Clean Water, which represented the Concerned Pastors for Social Action and the Democracy Defense League, which had formed to fight against this emergency manager law, and the a group called What Are You Fighting For? They and the ACLU of Michigan and Mark Edwards and his team at Virginia Tech, we came up with a plan. We're going to do our own water test. Mark got an emergency grant from the National Science Foundation, and I learned subsequently with tens and tens of thousands of dollars of his own money. You know, Mark is unbelievably incredible guy. You know, the altruism that he's shown throughout this is unequaled. So in any event, he gets the money to send 300 sample kits to Flint. And this is mid-August. We, you know, I start going up there. I'm working with the coalition. We hold, you know, public meetings to have people come in, tell them how to take the samples, get them distributed. We then, at a certain point, we see where they've been distributed, and because we're keeping very accurate records, we have, you know, everybody that's gotten a sample, what zip codes they're in. We go through, we map it all out, we see what parts of the city are not being hit, because we don't want them to have any legitimate reason to criticize our study. We want our study to be as thoroughly and scientifically valid as possible.
So you were actually taking these water testing kits into Flint homes yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, because we saw which zip codes were light, and me and Leanne Walters and her husband, you know, or just go out and start knocking on doors, say, hey, we're doing this. We can get your water tested for free. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. You know, we want to make sure that this neighborhood is represented. And so, yeah, we're going around knocking on doors, making sure that there's as equal distribution as possible throughout the city.
And what were your findings?
You know, first let me say that in a little over 2 weeks, this group, there was essentially seven people that were, you know, from the coalition and myself on our end working on this. In less than 3 weeks, we distributed 300 kits. We got 277 collected. When Mark applied for his National Science Foundation grant, said, we're going to send 300 kits. We're going to budget to get 75 back, because that's kind of like the typical rate of return.
Oh, wow.
We completely blew them away when we got 277, because, you know, people like Leanne Walters and Melissa Mays and, you know, the Pastors Association and others were so committed to this and so determined to do as good a job as we could possibly do, are out there working like crazy. We got four times as many samples as the city collected it in the prior 6 months to this. As soon as this, and the samples, they don't come all back in at the same time. We start handing them out. Some people, you get them back real quickly. So we start sending them back 12 at a time to Virginia Tech. As soon as Virginia Tech starts analyzing it, they're going, oh my God, we can't, you know, this is a real problem. And so instead of doing like a normal scientific study, right, until you get all your results and they publish your results, they start calling people with five parts per billion or above. They call and say, stop drinking your water. They create this website, flintwaterstudy.org. They start, Mark and his team of these students, you know, they're just so beautiful. They're like working around the clock to get these samples analyzed, to get the information posted on the web. Mark starts explaining the science going on, because they had also, he loaded up a minivan full of students, and they drove all the way from Virginia up to Flint for a couple days to do some like on the ground testing for other things, looking to see how much chlorine was in the water. And Mark was finding no chlorine. It was just like blew his mind. How could they not have any chlorine in the water? And so they're looking for other stuff. They go back to Virginia Tech. They're working like crazy around the clock. We're working like crazy, you know, feeling, you know, just intense pressure to do it and do it right and do it quickly. All this is going on between mid-August and September. And it's scary how much lead they're finding. Mark starts publishing the results. I write a story saying the early results are frightening. At the same time, I am doing a parallel investigation looking into what the city and state were doing in terms of their water testing. Because, okay, I know at that point that Virginia Tech's results are going to come in much higher than the city and state's results, which they continued to say was safe. And so we wanted to be able to explain why the discrepancy. And what I was able to find out through filing Freedom of Information Act requests and also, you know, some old-fashioned shoe leather reporting, going out and knocking on doors to answer some questions. The answer is the discrepancy is because the city and state cheat on their tests. In order to make it appear that they're in compliance, they're cheating, and there's no doubt about it. And so on September 15th, we hold a press conference. Mark comes there with a grad student and explains what they found, the science behind it. We hold a town hall meeting, and then I basically talk about the results of my investigation. And at that point, September 15th, keep in mind, as the ACLU of Michigan saying, there needs to be a complete and thorough outside investigation of what went on here. But the state continued to deny there was a problem. They started, you know, scurriously attacking the ethics and credibility of Mark, you know, who's a hero. You know, you guys know how he's felt about there in D.C., and the people in Flint feel the same way about him. Now, you know, the same guy, Werfel, from the MDEQ says, you know, this guy pulls a rabbit out of a hat wherever he goes. You know, as if he's skewing the results, man. Mark's one of the most ethical people I've ever met. It still burns me up thinking about the attack on him. And they're doing it because they're, here's the deal, and it goes to another flaw with the emergency manager law. There's no checks and balances. You have the governor's appointed emergency manager in charge when this disastrous decision to switch to the river is made. And then you have the MDEQ, which is headed by an appointee of the governor,
not
trying to protect people, but trying to cover up the horrible mistake that's been made by their boss, essentially.
Right.
So everybody's covering for the boss, which is Snyder here, Governor Rick Snyder. And so that's what we're up against. That's what we're fighting against in order to try to get the truth really out.
Yeah, Kurt, part of what strikes me about hearing you recount that story is how many people, how many private citizens at their own expense in money and time and energy had to, how much time and work you had to put in on your own just to demonstrate the fundamental problem with something as rudimentary as public water service. It took months and months and months of work from this really complex and broad coalition of groups and people that you just described for us to drag this into the light because the state officials who should have been doing that on behalf of the people of Flint were doing the opposite. And
yes,
Now that we find ourselves in almost February of 2016, with this being one of the premier national news stories going back to basically the beginning of this year, and it seems to only be getting louder in the national media, finally, two questions. One, what's that been like for you and the other people who put in all this time kind of backstage to make sure that this wouldn't go unremarked upon, to now finally have that attention that should have been paid to this story long ago arrive? And two, what's the update on how exactly they're continuing to deflect responsibility for this? Because my understanding is that while Snyder sort of went out of his way to say the words "I'm sorry" in his State of the State address, the administration is still spinning this real hard, right? So, given that you guys finally were able to get all of this into the public eye to the extent that it's now an unquestionably major national story, what's that like?
Answer both those questions, but let me just take one more step back to say what the game changer was, which was after we held our press conference. It actually is when the Virginia Tech results started to become known. There was a doctor at Hurley Children's Hospital, a pediatrician at Hurley Children's Hospital, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who started seeing these results and decided to do her own study, because Hurley is kind of a regional hospital. They had a lot of data regarding the blood levels in children 5 and under. So she looked at a 9-month period before the switch and a 9-month period after the switch, and found that the percentage of children with elevated levels of lead in their blood doubled after the switch, and that in areas where our tests were finding the highest lead levels in the water, she found the highest lead levels in the blood of kids. And so she nailed it. She nailed it in terms of the correlation between the lead in the water, but also the correlation between before when they were on the Detroit system to after when they were on the river water.
And so at that point, it basically becomes impossible for the state and for Snyder's team to continue denying that there's a problem here.
Except that they also attacked Hannah Atisha, who is also...
At least they're consistent.
Yes. I'm working on a short documentary now. It's called Deny and Attack.
Okay.
Because that was their whole MO, right?
Deny
there's a problem and you attack the people that are trying to tell the truth. And Hannah Atisha is a truth teller, and she's fearless and also incredibly ethical. That's sort of the, you know, part of the irony here. You got people like Brad Werfel attacking people like Mona Hannah Atisha and Mark Jack Edwards, he's not fit to shine their shoes and out there attacking them. So, they go after Hannah Atisha, saying the governor's spokeswoman, who is Brad's wife, Sarah Werfel, saying that Hannah Atisha spliced and diced her data. You know, again, this is slanderous to accuse a researcher of you know, manipulating their data to come to a certain outcome is a slanderous attack. What happened, though, was that the Detroit Free Press, which is the major daily here, one of the major dailies, got the state data and analyzed it themselves and said, you know what, there, Michigan, your data actually confirms what Hannah Atisha is reporting. And that was then the game over point. Although they still, even after that, tried to deny the connection to the river.
Right.
You know, they said, oh, it's these old lead service lines, which is the lead service lines is where the lead is leaching from. But it's because they're using this highly corrosive water and not applying the corrosion control. And so that until finally, in October, they say, okay, it is the river. And Snyder, at that point, finally lets the people of Flint go back to the Detroit system. But the problem is that the piping infrastructure has been so chewed up that it's taken a lot of time in order to get the water back to the point where it is safe. So that's... You know, that's sort of the whole story of how we got to where we are.
Yeah, that sequence that you're describing here over a year and a half or more of Snyder's team kind of defending one trench publicly for as long as they could until somebody proves, actually, no, that's not true. And then just sort of falling back to the next trench and standing strong in that one for as long as they can until they get outflanked and then falling back. They're doing it again now, right? I mean, they're continuing to... They can no longer say the water's safe. They can no longer say, well, the results that show the water's unsafe are skewed. They can no longer say, well, it's really just about the pipes. They're stuck acknowledging that it's the river water and that the source sin here from a public policy perspective was the decision to draw water from that river without treating it properly. And so now it seems like, as best I can tell, from this far away, it seems like they've retreated to a new sort of defense point here, which is the argument that we weren't the ones who decided to go back to the river. It was the city of Flint itself, and they're trying to say that the city council voted to do that. My understanding is that's not just a he said she said. This is a provably false narrative still from the Snyder administration, because we've got, am I right, that there are documents that illustrate that city officials in Flint who were already being overridden by an emergency manager had told the state, no, we don't want to use river water, and that emergency managers proceeded to put that plan into effect over and above those expressed local wishes, right?
Exactly. And we know that because of another document that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which is in March of 2014. So the decision and the city council, what they're doing is they're taking a kernel of truth, which is that the city council and mayor approved of the city leaving the Detroit system and getting their water from this new pipeline that's being built from Lake Huron. But it's still under construction. And so the lie is, and I got one of the emergency managers on tape actually uttering it, was that Detroit, after that decision to go with the pipeline was made, Detroit canceled a long-term contract, but which is true, and that Governor Snyder pointed that out in his State of the State speech. But what he didn't point out was that Detroit wanted to keep selling Flint water for as long as Detroit could keep selling them water, because Flint is their biggest suburban customer. So losing them as a customer was a huge, huge financial hit. And that's the lie by omission in the State of the State speech, or, you know, a direct lie that Detroit kicked Flint off its system. That's the lie, and that's a provable lie based on this document from Darnell Early, the emergency manager over Flint in 2014, and now the emergency manager over Detroit Public Schools. So you have the guy that was directly involved in the lead poisoning of Flint children in charge of the well-being of the 46,000 kids that remain in Detroit Public School System. You know, so that's another one of the sort of sick ironies of all this. But Early, his name is on a letter to Detroit saying, received your offer, thanks, but no thanks. We decided to go with the river. So, you know, they can try to weasel their way around this all they want, but eventually that, you know, truth is going to stick, and it's going to stick good once and for all. And we have another short video called Circle of Lies, where we have the emergency manager saying Detroit kicked them off. We have the governor's spokeswoman, Sarah Werfel, Brad's wife, saying that Detroit kicked them off. And then we have Howard Kroft, the former director of Public Works, on tape, and he starts to say that lie. And I stop him. I say, Howard, stop right there, man. I got the letter from Early. You know, don't give me that BS. What's the truth? And he kind of crumbled right there on camera. It's sort of amazing to watch. But he says, okay, Detroit cancels the contract, and we do a financial analysis to see what's best for the city of Flint. And that analysis goes up into the state is involved, and that the decision's made to use the river. And I go, that decision, does that go all the way to the governor's office? And Howard looks and he says, all the way to the governor's office. So that's why Snyder, you know, is given his lies of omission in the state of the state speech, because if Howard Kroft is to be believed, then his office was directly involved in making that decision. And when you ask people a direct question, why would his, she's now a former spokeswoman. There's a lot of former people involved in this story at this point because they keep resigning. But, you know, if you ask someone, was your boss involved in this decision? And she says, oh, he couldn't have been involved because, you know, Flint was kicked off the Detroit system. So how could we have made that decision?
Well, and Kurt Guyette, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
In the last minute that we have, since you're, yes. I mean, you're bringing up, you know, Snyder's role in this and lies by omission in his state of the state speech. There have been calls for him to resign.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe that's a fair and warranted outcome here. Maybe it would amount to partial justice for the great havoc that has been wreaked in the lives of poor and largely black families in Flint. Do you think that Governor Snyder should resign? And do you think that that would do anything to advance a sense of justice by those impacted in the city?
Well, you know, I'm a reporter, and it's not really my role to say whether the governor should resign or not. But I'll tell you, from a personal perspective, you know, The head of the Department of Environmental Quality has resigned. Brad Werfel, the spokesman, has resigned. Howard Kroft has resigned. The head of the EPA Region 5 has resigned. But you know what? Kids were poisoned here. Kids are going to be damaged for their whole lives as a result of this. And, you know, when people say heads roll, you know, a resignation, that's not, to me, that's not any head rolling. And if there are crimes committed here, people need to be prosecuted, and you know, resignations aren't enough as far as I'm concerned.
Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the ACLU of Michigan. He was instrumental in breaking the story of the Flint water crisis over a year ago. Kurt, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Alan Pike, sitting in for Tracy Ross. Back in 2013, Washington, D.C. struck a handshake deal with Walmart to open several stores in the district. And some of those stores are already open, but two of them never will be. The company announced on Friday that it's reneging on that promise, and it's doing so in a way that has undeniable racial overtones. Two of the new Walmarts were supposed to be built east of the Anacostia River in a part of Washington that's poorer, blacker, and more neglected than the glitzier parts that you see on TV. But the district, which had only agreed to let the company build here on the condition that those two stores would go up, it now isn't going to get them. It's all gone up in smoke. Joining us to dig into this story is Nikki Lewis, the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice. Nikki, thanks for coming on Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a little bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your experience working in D.C. on labor justice issues and how Walmart's been a part of that over your tenure there.
Yeah, absolutely. DC Jobs and Justice, we are a community, labor, student, and faith coalition dedicated to protecting and advancing the rights of D.C. area workers and residents. 3 years ago, I became the director of this organization, although I have been involved much longer, doing solidarity efforts around restaurant and retail low-wage working conditions in order to improve them. And when I became the director several years ago, we were deep into the fight around Walmart. Walmart at the time, this was 2011, mm-hmm. 2012, was proposing to come to the district and open six different stores within our 20-mile radius. Our council members had been courting them for several years and other retailers to come and develop Washington, provide mm-hmm. jobs. DC Jobs and Justice folks in Ward 7 and Ward 4 in particular, and some of our grocery and retail unions were particularly concerned about this, as we've seen over the years the trends that the Walmart Corporation has on the impacts that they have on wages, working benefits, and the overall landscape. We're really concerned about the low wages, the poverty wages, the environmental impact that they would have, the lack of benefits that they have. Folks got together and demanded or tried to negotiate some community benefits agreements, saying okay. that Walmart, if you're going to come into D.C., we need you to provide a living wage, and we need you to agree to some basic benefits for the community. Basically, what happened over a year-long time, Walmart refused to put anything in writing.
Sure.
Behind closed doors, they said that they would provide living wages, that they would start at $13.50 an hour at the stores mm-hmm. that they built here, but they would never put it in writing or actually agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
Our community residents didn't trust that. We want to see something in writing, something that's guaranteed. And so our advocacy efforts moved into a campaign around the Large Retailer Accountability Act. At that time in D.C., you probably saw on almost every lawn a sign that said, "Respect D.C. Walmart, please respect D.C., meaning, you know, accommodate the cost of living here and the things that our residents need.
Right.
Long story short, about a year working with Phil Mendelson and other leaders on the council, the Large Retailer Accountability Act had 9 votes on the council to pass it, which would guarantee that Walmart provided a living wage. But unfortunately, our mayor at the time, Vincent Gray vetoed the council's vote, and then during the revote, we didn't have enough votes to pass it. And so what that means is that Walmart moved into D.C., building currently three stores, but has no kind of written agreement or accountability of any sort about the wages or conditions there, or about the terms of development.
Right, right. So they'll be subject to the standard citywide minimum wage, but none of the sort of augmentations to that that would be required to raise somebody's actual income to something that would approach an amount of money to actually be able to live on in D.C.
Correct, correct. And so what has happened now, Walmart has built three stores in Northwest and Northeast neighborhoods that need development, but certainly have more development and infrastructure than our brothers and sisters east of the river in Ward 7, where they desperately need living wage jobs and more access to retail and food service and grocery stores, all of these things. So Walmart has effectively taken less risk by developing in wealthier neighborhoods and left the folks who need it the most behind and without guaranteeing any kind of wages.
Right. Yeah. Can you, for our listeners who may not be as familiar with DC geography and the sort of the social map of this town, can you drill down a little bit more into what you mean? What is it that, and I, you know, I've lived here for about 5 years. I think I know what you mean, but for our listeners, the neighborhoods that you're talking about, Northeast and Northwest, in the those quadrants of the Diamond of D.C. as compared to the parts of Southeast that are on the far side of the Anacostia River. If somebody were to drive, you know, from the middle of Northwest out to Anacostia, what would they see? What are the defining characteristics of these communities, and how does that reflect or play into Walmart's decision making here?
Absolutely. So, great question. The city of Washington, D.C. is very diverse. We were about 48% African-American residents and about 30% Caucasian, about 17% Latino, etc. So mm-hmm. we're very diverse, but what we have here is concentrations of different races and class statuses within wards. And that's common in a lot of cities, but
sure.
here in D.C., in wards 7 and 8, which are east of the Potomac River, you have the highest concentration of African American residents. And so when you are driving from what this means, to answer your question, when you're driving from Northwest, where you're downtown or you're in wards 1, 2, or 3, where there's a abundance of wealth, some of the highest disposable incomes in the nation, you see that reflected in the geography, in the buildings, in the type of jobs that are there, in the types of services and transportation that is available. When you cross the river, while there is a thriving and beautiful African-American population, they're still fighting for development in Ward 7 and 8. I'm talking about better sidewalks and just general infrastructure. I'm talking about access to grocery stores. There are food deserts in Ward 7 and 8. So these are the kind of structural inequalities that groups like DC Jobs and Justice are trying to overcome and transform. And so when you have a large employer coming in that wants to develop these areas, it's very important that the needs of the community are actually met. We're talking about living wage jobs that enable people to have self-determination and to really reinvest in their own community. But if you don't have that there, then, I mean, we're continuing a system of racial discrimination and economic disenfranchisement.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us on Talk Poverty Radio, our guest is Nikki Lewis, the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice, and we're talking about how Walmart sort of manipulated people's expectations in the DC area and staved off a piece of legislation that would have required them to pay a living wage to all their workers at the stores that they've committed to building in D.C. Nikki, I understand that it's not just it goes deeper than just the failure to deliver the job opportunities and the shopping opportunities and the cost savings to consumers that come from a Walmart in an equitable way across the map of D.C. that in addition to failing to deliver on that promise of opportunity, they've backed out of building stores in locations that where they had already begun to raise a number of properties, including some convenience stores and other much smaller sort of locally owned, locally run businesses that have been in those very same communities for some time, and so is that right that they've the folks in those communities are not only looking at not being able to realize whatever benefits might come from a Walmart being located nearby, but they've actually lost options that had been available to them for a long time?
Well, yeah. Skyland and Capital Gateway, like, the Walmart is supposed to be an anchor institution that would help draw in more businesses and raise up the area, but without really anchor tenants in these areas that drives more traffic and foot traffic there, it will make it difficult for the smaller businesses to thrive or to get started. So we need to, I mean, it's an opportunity, though, for us to find a better tenant.
Yeah.
A better employer, better services. So we're very excited to have the opportunity to reconvene with residents in Ward 7 and develop a better vision.
What's that going to look like, that process of trying to involve people from the communities that are actually being directly affected by these decisions in that process? Is that a matter of trying to sort of get people in front of members of the city council, or is this more in private sector hands at this point?
Honestly, it could be a combination of both, I think. The D.C. City Council here, they're elected by residents, and so not only the city council members, but the ANC commissioners. So I think it's very important for folks in those communities to voice their opinions and voice their proposed solutions to the elected officials that they're accountable to, that are accountable to them. But I also think that it's important for residents and community folks to organize and take things into their own hands. And so I really think it will be a combination approach.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can you give us a morale report? How are folks feeling? The kinds of people who you guys engage with and who you've spent, I imagine, in some cases years sort of cultivating relationships with and mobilizing for change and to apply pressure in favor of these kinds of ideas around D.C. At this point, this sounds like a long fight, a period of years. You mentioned sort of people beginning on a footing of we don't really want Walmart here, and arriving at a place of, well, if they're going to come, then we need them to agree to these conditions that will be beneficial to our communities, and kind of warming up to the idea, I guess, and then Walmart just pulls the rug out from under folks. That's got to be a whirlwind. How are people in the communities that you organize in taking all that?
The reactions I've been getting are people are angry about it, but also not surprised. And so...
Why not? We're not surprised.
Well, we're not surprised because Walmart has a history of paying low wages, but also really competing against themselves, meaning that in... towns all across America, they open up a store and then open up another store or a super center like a mile or two away from itself. They will compete with themselves, close the store or stores that are doing less profitable, and then drive the rest of their business to the other nearby Walmart, and therefore cut their labor expenses and benefits in half with less of staff. So that's something, if you do any research online or talk to folks in major cities and towns across the country, like, this is not something new. This is a trend that they have been doing for decades now. And so that's why we're not surprised. And it was
sure.
also one of the concerns that we had when our council members courted them to come here, and then they came back with saying, well, we'll build 6 or 7 stores here within a
yeah.
small 20-mile
yeah.
radius.
Yeah, that's a
that's
really high density.
That's why we're not surprised. Yeah, we're not surprised. But like I said, I think the leaders in Ward 7 are taking this as an opportunity mm-hmm. to build power and come up with an alternative solution for development and living wage jobs.
Yeah, and somebody's got to do that work. I mean, the pace at which real estate development happens in this city, especially in the parts of the map that we were talking about earlier that are viewed fairly or unfairly, that are viewed as desirable, I guess is probably the code word that the development community uses, just get chewed through so fast in, you know, and get put to purposes in those new developments that are not going to serve well anybody who does manage to stick around in the neighborhood where they've lived for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. The speed at which gentrification is not just sort of flipping over whole blocks of property into new uses, but also pushing out the people who stayed and stuck it out and survived the leaner times in those neighborhoods has been really dizzying, even in my relatively brief time in D.C. and even, you know, living in the middle of Northwest and too rarely venturing out from there. I can't imagine that folks in Ward 7 are all that eager to wait around for those same economic forces to migrate across the river.
No, there's been a demand and a growing voice for accountable development for years in Ward 7. It is a struggle. I think that the struggle that they are facing in terms of gaining development and having the means to create their own development or getting equitable resources from the actual city budget to do infrastructural and business incentive type of development. In my personal opinion, is an example of structural racism,
yeah.
really, against communities of color that historically have disproportionately been impacted by poverty and discrimination. And that has a cumulative effect over our history. And so now we're trying to deal with that. We're still
Absolutely.
Trying to overcome and deal with that.
And as you say, these fights take on new forms almost every day. So we'll have to have you back on to talk about some of these other battles that y'all are waging down there. Thank you so much, Nikki Lewis.
Absolutely.
From DC Jobs with Justice. Thanks for being on Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also find us on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. East, 8 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom,
freedom.
Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?